I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran. And this is Radio versus the Martians. Arrival came at the Denis Villeneuve movie came at a point, I mean, it basically came out in November of 2016, but it also came at a point where for just more than, I can't even say when it started, but for more than a few decades, it might have even started in the 80s, our popular sci-fi visions have sort of drifted to the point where we're fearful, and it's about sci-fi is about invasions or catastrophe. And in Arrival, it did the opposite. It made a movie that's about communication. It made a movie that it's about coming in contact with the other, and the other being threatening, because it always is, right? I mean, that which you do not understand is always going to have the possibility to radically disrupt what is stable in your life, in your city, in your civilization. But the premise is that through communication, communication can learn to not only break down the problem of between the self and the other, but lead to saving one another, basically leading to doing the thing that both us and the other need at that time, you know? Like, and it was entirely, it's such a beautiful, affecting message for a sci-fi movie, but like, it is a rare gem among dozens and dozens of other just almost completely interchangeable type of sci-fi movies that don't care about that mostly care about it being a backdrop to hang the same story over and over and over again with different pieces moved around.
Well, there's comfort food, and I think that science fiction like that is challenging, and
science fiction from the beginning was always a challenging thing, right? I mean, we just got finished talking about Return to Oz, which I think has a lot of sci-fi elements mixed in with the fantasy. But the corollary would be like H.G. Wells. Like, mm-hmm.
It was about colonialism. It was what War of the Worlds was about. I mean, yeah. That was the British people. That was what we did to people that were quote unquote savages. And that's that we didn't think of them as people. We treated them like cattle. We rolled in and we just killed them indiscriminately because we didn't see them as fully human. And that is exactly what the Martian tripods do to us in that story.
Right, right.
Except in colonialism, it was us that brought the diseases usually. Yes. And but yeah, it's
watched by intelligences cold and indifferent. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's that same kind of thing.
That's very easy. That is a message that's very easy to have as a stand-in for us in a sci-fi story. And I think maybe this is the piece. I think you still haven't even dipped your toe into Star Trek Discovery, I'm guessing.
No, it's still behind a paywall.
Yeah, maybe that for me is the piece that I feel is missing from what I've seen so far. And I really have stopped hitting myself. I think I stopped watching a couple, maybe three episodes into the second season.
Oh, the second season wasn't doing it for you? I've heard the second season was a return to what people seem to want.
Bits and pieces were. I think the idea of Star Trek, you want a moralizing message in Star Trek. I think you don't want. I mean, sometimes you're over moralized in Star Trek, to be sure.
Well, everything is execution. I mean, Captain Planet has a good message. There's nothing in it. The problem is it's so ham-fisted,
right,
and so unsubtle that it almost makes you want to go outside and burn styrofoam in your backyard.
Yeah, yes.
It's just because there's a limit to how a good message can be enough. And if it's wielded like, as our good friend Jeff Goldblum says in Jurassic Park, like a child wielding his dad's gun, you know, it's... We use this stuff haphazardly. If it's done badly, then people will have the opposite reaction. They will reject that message, even if it's a good one. And I think there's a power to media that is in service of an idea. And Star Trek has been very mixed, but mostly good in this way of portraying, you know, a future that you'd want to live in. And again, yeah, we use that example of Star Trek versus Planet of the Apes, the carrot and the stick. The Planet of the Apes is us not getting our shit together.
So we're circling the drain about what's in my basement. I think the last time we had one of these heart-to-heart talks, Mike, we were talking about the stuff that was in your basement that you felt like you weren't ready to have on the show. We had tried to articulate a few times and got to a certain point. Is for me, my basement is, I mean, you're a comic book lifer. I'm just like a sci-fi guy lifer. And like mine is our total inability at this point to want to use popular fiction, sci-fi in particular, to try to project futures that are anything other than either complete catastrophe or this sort of a hyperization of the sort of capitalist world that we're actually in right now. And you can't, there are people whose job it is to sort of weave these stories together and make them corporate products for our entertainment, apparently are only either able or only interested in pushing one of these two visions. And I think it is hurting us. I think it hurts for, on a more personal level, it hurts me because I hate to fall into the, I don't want to fall into the misapprehension that the only possibility of our future is complete calamity, and that we were too stupid to be able to get it to communicate with each other, to work to solve problems. And I also don't want to believe that the inevitability for me is just sort of like this insanely crowded, hot world full of despair. And the only reason why we weren't able to do any better was because we were just sort of seduced by things, right? Yeah. Seduced by acquisition of things.
Well, it's also...
Humans can do better than that. So why don't we have fiction that shows us doing better than that?
But it's the insidiousness of nostalgia, too.
Yeah.
That we do kind of harken back to that time when we didn't really understand the world in three dimensions.
Yeah.
And it was a simpler time because we were simpler people, because we were children. And the need to sort of want to recapture that, I understand it. But I think you can also wallow in it in so much. And what you don't do with nostalgia is you don't project forward. That right. It's all about sort of recreating that. And this is something that...
Which was my biggest complaint about Discovery, by the way.
Yeah.
Is that to make a new show, they had to be going back into the past.
I think they should project forward. I think that's a thing Star Trek should absolutely do. And I think it's what we're likely to get with this Picard show, which is jumping forward. But it was kind of... There was Mark Russell, who is the comic book writer who did the Flintstones reboot, mm-hmm. the Snagglepuss reboot. Mm-hmm. He's a brilliant guy. Said something, I forget what it was exactly, so I'm just going to paraphrase. This is on Facebook a while back about that there is something insidious about nostalgia because we graft onto that stuff and we hold on to it because it makes us happy. And then when people want to change it, we fight back. Not because, you know, we're not rejecting changes to this thing that we remember when we were kids because we're racist or sexist or whatever. We're just nostalgic. But our nostalgia is calling us in the direction of that time and not wanting it to change. So it doesn't really matter on some level because we may not think that we're racist or anything like that, but we're refusing change. We're refusing forward momentum. And it is a sort of weird kind of conservatism that if we allow ourselves to be so doctrinaire about this shit, that we don't want to move forward. And again, this is that question that I ask myself all the time, and we joke about it, but there is an existential dread sort of lurking underneath it, which is, are we old?
Yeah. You know, for me...
Do we even believe we can change things, or are we just at that point where all we can do is coast to the end?
That's garbage. I mean, that has to be garbage because I think that every human generation that's came to... People have coasted into the last third of their lives feeling the same thing, largely because, you know, you are replaced by the generation that comes after you. I feel like the thing that is the most upsetting to me, and that this sort of nostalgia, holding to this nostalgia as the primary means that we want to express stories about ourselves, is it represents this, I think, outmoded idea that we still carried forward from the 20th century, largely from the baby boomers, that we are the best, that our generation is the best, that the the world we've crafted for ourselves, what we expect out of the world, and what we think is possible is what matters, and no one else will tell us different, and we shouldn't try to change it because this is the way that it
should
be.
But it's also the wounded idealist bullshit that the baby boomers will throw out, and they're just, you know, George McGovern lost an election in 1972, and it wasn't the death of all hope. It doesn't. Right. For a lot of these people, it was an if you can't beat them, join them moment, where they became worse than their parents.
For me, this is the same reason. I mean, we were talking about it in the political sphere, but that's important. I just, like, right now, I maybe it's just the form of self therapy that I need to have right now, because everyone needs some form of therapy they apply to themselves. Is like, I want to engage in thinking about a near, middle, and far term future that isn't one of those things that doesn't say about us that we are doomed to be just sort of as petty and as banal as a late 20th century human was. Like, I do believe that we have the potential to get past that. And so, like, unfortunately, it means this genre that I love so much, I want to consume less and less of it. And, you know, I'm a huge movie guy. I watched 190-something movies last year that I hadn't seen. Trying to beat your record, Mike.
Yeah.
And the thing that I find is that the more new cinema that I watch that isn't, and most of it obviously is not, like, not sci-fi stuff.
Yeah, some of it is fun trash, and that's okay.
The more cinema that I watch from this era or from other eras or from all over the world is there's a lot more to say about what it means to be human and to try to find those sort of feelings and scenarios that make you feel something inside that is more than just sort of like the stillborn sense of dread and despair that I think comes out of science fiction normally. And there's so much feeling and emotion and experience to sort of share in those cultural properties that it makes me love that science fiction piece a lot less, because it's been ghettoized now, I guess.
We sort of talked about this a little bit before we recorded this, but one of the things that I really loved about the movie Star Trek First Contact is that Star Trek is a post-apocalyptic movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's a thing that if you look at the way that Star Trek in all series and iterations would talk about our past, how did we get from where we are now to the world that Captain Kirk and later Captain Picard have, there was always kind of a vagueness, whether you have like Khan mixed in there, World War III, all this stuff. But there was a real sense that humanity went off a cliff for a while. And it was never made explicit, but the thing that I really love in Star Trek First Contact is it took all of those things and it said, let's tell a story about the moment that we turned it around. That it wasn't this insurmountable thing, like, the world of The Walking Dead is fucked. I don't see anyone sort of pulling it out, and the thing that seems to happen over and over again is that we get really close and then we find a way to burn it to the ground and we have to start from scratch. The world that Rick is sort of created with these different societies on there, that's some hope. And it's the same reason when I play a Fallout game, why I side with somebody who wants to create some kind of justice and fairness in the world. Because there's a lot of ways in those games that let you make moral choices in a post-apocalyptic landscape about morality. But I don't want to be somebody who's just like a vulture grabbing the carcass. I want to say, I know that my character is only going to get so far in this world and I can't actively change it past a certain point, but can I pretend that I'm somebody who's loosening the jar just a little bit?
Yeah.
And saying that we have a broken world, but it's not doomed. That there's something there, that first contact idea that Zefram Cochrane lived in a world that had been bombed to shit. It was irradiated and broken and destroyed by war. Most of the major cities were there. I don't know how many hundreds of millions they say are dead.
Who knows? Don't remember.
It's like countless.
Yeah.
It's a broken fucking world. And that movie's about how it's not broken forever. And it's about how you look at the world of Star Trek The Next Generation and say, this world came from that. And it's not like we're living in the rubble using broken, repurposed versions and material that was manufactured by some long ago person. We're making stuff that's better than that world that was destroyed. And that's something we don't see a lot of, the idea that an apocalyptic dystopian world is something that can be fixed and made just and kinder and more empathetic.
Well, and largely, I think, isn't the idea should be that if you can do it with a dystopian world, you can do it with the one we have right here. And that is the through line that I want, you know. I don't want to believe that 95% of the human population has to die for us to figure it out. Like, we can figure it out. Like, teach the next wave of these human beings that are going to have some real hard times, teach them that it can be done.
Have some ambition about where you want the world to be, and don't just manage your expectations. I created a series of memes last week. I don't know if you saw those on Facebook.
Sorry, I did not see those on Facebook.
Okay.
You talked to a guy who's completely unplugged from social media entirely.
Mostly, so. It's just been a response to a certain attitude that I've seen lately, that sort of corporate, kind of, let's just say, like, sort of fetishistic centrism that you see a lot. Mm-hmm. And it always comes back to that same question, but how are we going to pay for this? So the images I use are specifically scenes in movies where people are coming up at a meeting for the last-ditch plan to save the world, whether it's the Council of Elrond or all the pilots on Yavin looking at things. But how are we going to pay for this? And the question of whether it's worth some level of treasure and inconvenience to save ourselves or not. And I think the answer is yes, that we should ask ourselves this. It's the same thing. Like, what if you just said that to Bill Pullman in Independence Day? Yeah, but you know, we could go up there with all these planes, but what's this going to cost us? And we have to say, it could cost us a better world. It could give us a better world. Because, and again, let's fucking try. We're never going to have anything unless we make it worth it, because we can incrementally slow down our movement towards the cliff, or we can change direction. And it seems like we act as if it's such an imposition for us to change direction, yep, because it would just inconvenience the people that are benefiting from the world that we have now. And the people who benefit from the world right now, they want to slow down so they can just kind of get a bit more of that money for a longer period, because they're being an adult about this catastrophe, but they act as if, you know, changing it is there. Let's be quote unquote unrealistic. And it's not unrealistic, because most of the things, and again, to get off on my socialist tirade here,
God damn it, Mike.
It's not like this shit's untested. We do
live in a small Central American socialist country here in Valverde.
Valverde.
Yes, it's fine.
But yeah, we were going in the right direction until John Matrix killed our leader.
God damn it.
I really think that our science fiction has to be there too. Why not create an example we can follow? I love dystopian, sad, depressing shit as much as anybody, but you kind of have to get some diversity in your diet, tonally, genre-wise.
Yeah, yeah.
That I think that enough of that, this is the thing I said to people when they start reading The Walking Dead or watching The Walking Dead, it's like, read it in chunks, take a break for maybe 6 months to a year in between those chunks, get some happy shit in there, and find a way to diversify that, because I think this shit wears down on you, and you get in your head that stuff is broken and you can't fix it, and the best you can do is be a scavenger in the horrible new world to come. And I don't fucking want that.
Yeah. And not only do I think that's, but that's not an alternative.
That's
no. Just not an alternative.
But we act as if, you know, we can just have a continuation of what we have or something worse.
I don't know.
That's like a real fucking Henry Kissinger type problem. I mean, that's that kind of bullshit where we act as if we can either do this terrible, awful thing that we're doing right now, or we can have catastrophe. And that's a bullshit dynamic.
I don't know, Mike. You call it post-capitalism, call it post-scarcity. You call it Boko Nonoism. I don't know what it is, but like, why don't we articulate it? I think the problem is that we're so impoverished. Our sort of cultural understanding is so impoverished that it's just sort of like, well, it's communism. Like, you know, like Star Trek is space communism with a military attached to it. Like, well, maybe, but I don't think that's what it is. Like, maybe very simple understanding of a writer at Paramount in 1967, like, perhaps that was all it went. But the idea of it as a sort of a functioning idea to be the basis for a franchise, for a universe, essentially.
But like, at the same time, just because you don't like one aspect of it doesn't mean you should throw out the idea of saying, well, you know, it's the same thing. It's like, you know what? That Green New Deal goes too far, so I'm just going to vote for the Nazi. You know, it's that kind of bullshit where it's like, no, let's aim high. It's like, you know, maybe you don't like that aspect of the utopian future. Well, then pick the other part. Pick the part where you can be an artist or a sculptor or any of these things, and you can be motivated entirely by your passions and your ability to create something great rather than basic subsistence.
What if you just want to get drunk every day and do nothing? Wouldn't you want to, you know, I always like to imagine how a great society would work even if I weren't myself. Maybe this is a little bit of myself,
but again,
what if you just wanted to get, what would a society look like if you just wanted to jam heroin in your arm every day and have as little complications as possible? Like, would that be a bad society?
This is a bullshit notion. They act as if that's everybody. And yeah, the only thing keeping us on the straight and narrow is having a fucking boss.
Right.
No, that's bullshit. No, it's not that. It's not. It's like, well, if I didn't have to pay rent, I'd be a total reprobate. No, that's fucking bullshit. And you know who tells you that? Your fucking landlord.
Yes.
And your boss. Because if you didn't have to do, this is me really getting on my socialist tirade.
The true parasites? You mean the ones who make money and prestige off of your work? Is that what you mean? Yes, the true parasites.
The people who they do nothing for a living but own shit.
Yes.
So yeah, they're the mask has been torn away. But yeah, it's fucking tiring. It's fucking tiring, and those are the people that also own the media companies that are selling us the idea that, again, it's catastrophe or the sort of like consumerist bullshit. And I love a lot of the consumerist bullshit. Where none of us are, we all have blood on our knives. But it's just, can we break it up a little bit? Can we, when we try harder, we have access to greater ability to share art than we ever have. Can we use some of that to not just make another fucking Ninja Turtles cartoon?
I don't know. I hope I mean,
the baby boomers wrecked our economy, but we wrecked our pop culture.
Right.
The Gen Xers.
Right.
Because we're the ones that refuse to give any of it up. It's like, take pensions and the social safety net and everything the fucking boomers destroyed. That's what we did to movies and popular culture, because we just decided that we are going to ossify everything from the time between we were 9 and 13 and refused to move on from it and just recreated over and over again.
This far and no further.
Yes, that's exactly what we did.
Siege mentality of culture, yeah. No, I think we should, for many things, including our most cherished childhood franchises, we should be willing to just leave some things behind. We should be okay with some things being left behind, you know.
Plenty of things are left behind. I mean, there's a lot of things, like, you know, I like a lot of things about it, but the Lone Ranger is kind of done as a franchise. We've sort of learned that because people didn't keep it up. It hasn't been, this is like Captain Marvel, the original Captain Marvel from the 1940s, mm-hmm. Billy Batson, aka Shazam. He was a character that, because of legal reasons, really didn't exist between the late 1950s and the 70s when DC bought the rights to him. You know, so he didn't change gradually. Why is it that somebody like the Shadow was always treated as a period piece character, but Batman, who was created around the same time, always exists in the present day? Why is one of these things considered retro and the other one? Because Batman has been continually published and updated gradually. So he's always been a part of the present. There are certain things we just didn't pick up. And you know what? Some of the stuff you love, too, is going to be left behind because future generations won't give a shit about it.
No. You know,
it's okay.
And we are we obviously do live in this sort of like weird remixy, everything old is new again, sort of idea. And the danger is, of course, of just losing yourself into a vortex, an abyss of the same things that you loved before. Obviously, we're circling this conversation of speaking of that abyss. But I can't help but think of, like, the thing I was interested in is the very first Final Fantasy game for the NES, which, if you've never played, you know it by reputation. Right?
I've played it briefly.
There is a community of people who have, and these, I don't know, I can't speak to the ages of any of these people, but I imagine some of them must be software developers, and they do this in their spare time. They've done to the game what's called, they've randomized it. So effectively, they've sort of torn apart the game's code, and every time there is a treasure chest in one place, or an item you're supposed to get from an NPC, or even the special ability of a monster on the world, they've sort of shaken it up.
So it's in different places now.
So you can walk into the item shop the magic shop in the first town and get the most perhaps get the most powerful spell in the entire game and be able to just like zoom through spamming that for the entire time. Or you can be sort of in a drought and not be able to even find a good weapon for the first 30 minutes of the game and go there. And the seeds, as they call them, each one is different. They're randomized and they're different. And so there's a community of people that are sort of speed running these, where they say like, let's go through these and let's make it a competition. Like these four people will go through, and the one to win, get to the end of the game and beat Chaos, is going to be the one who wins, and we'll do a bracket. It'll just be a competition thing. In this scenario, though, a good deal of the people who are running this game, you'd think, oh, guys like me, 30-something guys like me, they're the ones who are, I've played Final Fantasy a bunch of times, now I want to play it 100 more times because I'm interested in only that. The people that are speedrunning this, a lot of them are of an age where they were not born when the first Final Fantasy was created. So we're talking about people that have sort of rolled forward, and now that there's something fresh and new and fun to re-experience of this, that's not just playing the same game over and over, the same game over and over again, that's something that is special and unique and that is experienced with other people at the same time. And these are people that don't have the same sort of attachment of being like, oh, that was my first RPG game. That stuff to me is beautiful. That stuff to me is absolutely beautiful. And I totally recognize, like, this comes hat in hand with the same, this is linked to the same thing that makes people want to be like, well, I'll only ever play this game and no play no more games because I don't care about modern video games. I just this idea that to take something and make it fresh and make it something that's relatable and interesting and to someone who wasn't there when it was around originally is great, is fantastic.
Yeah, I think there's ways
and to shape it. It doesn't have to be a J.J. Abrams produced movie to do that.
Yeah,
also,
that was one of the things that I loved, speaking of the Abramsverse, so to speak, is Star Trek Beyond started that. It did some of that aspirational world building we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to live on that space station.
Yeah,
that's the
Yorktown,
first time,
baby.
That thing was amazing, and it was the vision of a world that I would like to live in. And I don't remember the last time I saw something like that in a movie, where I'm like, "Holy crap! I'd love to jump into that world." I mean, we all play zombie hypothetical survival games where if I'm thrown, you're thrown into Dawn of the Dead, what do you do? And we go, oh, okay, I do this, and I'd probably be living out of an old Costco, and and we play those games, but we never say, well, what kind of world would we want to live in? I don't want to live in that world. It sounds like a shithole, and I'm not incredibly valuable as somebody who's not a doctor, not a helicopter pilot, I've never fired a gun in my life. I would be useless unless there is like some secret vault full of supplies, and the only way to get in there is to answer questions about Marvel Comics. That's my moment, but it's probably not going to come. And, you know, I don't want to, you know, it's fun to play those games in a hypothetical way, but do you really want to, like, let's just say that world, that door right now to the studio is now a portal to another dimension. What world, fictional world, would you want it to be? Because I guarantee you it's not like the Planet of the Apes. You know, I'd really like to wear a loincloth and be hunted by gorillas on horses. I love that movie to death, but no fucking way would I want to live there. That's one of the worst. It's like, I want to go to the Terminator future. I would want to open that up in some fucking Yorktown.
Yeah.
Every aspect of that would be immediately better than the life that I have now. And I have a pretty okay life for living in a, you know, post-capitalist fucking landfill. You know, I have it a lot better than a lot of other people do. I'm poor-ish, but it's, I would rather, I'd like to see a way to, we act as if there's no way to tell a good story in a world that's aspirational. And I think that, was Star Trek The Next Generation one of the few futures where it's like, yeah, that looks pretty great.
Did you ever watch the Joaquin Phoenix movie Her?
No.
Did you see that one?
Is that that's the one where he dates his operating system?
Yeah. That was an articulation of a near future world that wasn't a calamity at all. That was a the great part about it was is that they didn't go out of their way to like throw in, you know, a totalitarian government or, you know, some kind of, I don't know, some other type of calamity like radiation or like extreme weather.
Nobody's being forced to play the Hunger Games.
No. There was that. And so it was a simple story that's about a love relationship between two persons, one of them being fleshy and the other being a robot. But it was in a setting where where it was in the future and what the future meant. It only meant that their future needed to be advanced enough that robots could be people too. That's it. That's all it was. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, some of that stuff is like, oh, that's intriguing. Like, I love having it be a sci-fi story because it could have been a story just about a boy and a girl, a man and a woman falling in love. But the little sci-fi bit gave a little twist. Yeah. Like, it's what happens. It's basically about what happens when your significant other becomes better than you and wants to give you up because you're not as exciting as other people. Wants to date other people. It's what happens when you find out that your significant other is better than you and wants to date other people.
Oh, been there.
I just spoiled the whole movie for you. Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh. Radio vs. the Martians is hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. This podcast is recorded in beautiful Valverde in Seattle, Washington. Our chief engineer is Casey Dorn, and our editor is Mike Gillis. Our original theme music is written and performed by James Wetzel. Special thanks to Sam Mulvey, Rob Kelly, James Wetzel, Paul Rue, Tobiah Panshin, Scott Kramer, Kyle Hepworth, and Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Please take the time to rate and review our show on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the show financially, please consider becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. Even just $1 a month gives you access to exclusive episodes. And you can always find us online at radioversusthemartians.com.
So, what is it you want me to do?
Simple. Conduct your warp flight tomorrow morning, just as you planned.
Why tomorrow morning?
Because at 11 o'clock, an alien ship will begin passing through this solar system.
Alien? You mean extraterrestrials? More bad guys?
Good guys. They're on a survey mission. They have no interest in Earth. Too primitive.
Oh.
Doctor, tomorrow morning when they detect the warp signature from your ship and realize that humans have discovered how to travel faster than light, they decide to alter their course, and they make first contact with Earth, right here.
Here?
Actually, over there.
It is one of the pivotal moments in human history, Doctor. You get to make first contact with an alien race, and after you do, everything begins to change.
Your theories on warp drive allow fleets of starships to be built, and mankind to start exploring the galaxy.
It unites humanity in a way that no one ever thought possible when they realize they're not alone in the universe. Poverty, disease, war, they'll all be gone within the next 50 years.
But unless you make that warp flight tomorrow morning, before 11:15, none of it will happen.
And you people, you're all astronauts on some kind of Star Trek.